Welcome back to the Justice to Healing podcast. I'm Dr. Christina Lanier, one of the co-directors of the National Drug Court Resource Center. Alongside me today, I have the other co-director, Dr. Kristen Duvall.
Hello.
We are excited today to have two special guests here on the Justice to Healing podcast to talk with us about tribal healing to wellness courts. First, we have Chief Judge Hopp of the McCall Tribe. Alongside him, we have Ms. Chris Pacheco. She's a tribal wellness court specialist at the Tribal Law and Policy Institute. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Fantastic. So this episode of Justice to Healing wraps up our first series, The State of the Field. We'll be looking at tribal healing to wellness courts today and learning more about these courts and how they operate and function.
Are there other challenges that you have seen tribal healing to wellness courts face? Certainly, you know, during COVID, but even pre-COVID, and what we might be able to learn from that.
As a TTA specialist, you know, that's where our big business is, is answering the call. But yes, both pre-COVID and COVID. COVID just exacerbated a lot of some of the struggles that Healing to Wellness Courts had. But it was also amazing to see some of their responses. Yeah. It was great. So some of the kind of the continued challenges or kind of constant challenges have been one, we mentioned it before, risk assessments, getting an accurate risk assessment and working with tribes to understand Healing to Wellness Court is designed specifically for high risk, high need. And then also working with them if they truly do want to offer services to different levels, developing track systems. There's a track for, you know, individuals who are high need, low risk, you know, and also getting them to understand of not kind of combining those services. So that's kind of one of the challenges, because like I said, in tribal communities, we kind of want to help everybody. We want to make sure that everybody gets taken care of. So that is one of the challenges. Another challenge is right before also COVID really impacted this was recruitment, getting individuals into Healing to Wellness Courts. You know, in the beginning, there are certain times where people come in front of a tribal judge, you know, during an arraignment, and they would say, you know, just give me my time. You know, I can do time. I can do time standing on my head. You know, why do I want to get into this program that I have to be here for a whole year and I have to do this and that, you know, so getting individuals. And that also kind of speaks to a legal side, is that sometimes there's a limited jurisdiction that tribal courts have. Mm-hmm. You know, they may only have a year of jail time that they can kind of commit to, you know, have someone sentenced to. And in Healing to Wellness Courts, as well as we know with drug courts, there is a legal carrot and a legal stick. And so they have to kind of see the benefit of, okay, I'm gonna stay out of jail for a whole year, but I kind of have to do this. Mm-hmm. This program that, you know, I have to go to treatment, I have to do some counseling, I have to do some other services, I might have to do some community service. So there has to kind of that getting them motivated to see that benefit, that recovery capital, right, is one of the things that I know tribes are having a hard time with. But COVID just made that worse, because individuals were, you know, they didn't want to hold individuals in detention or jail. You know, so that was one of the things that was an issue. And then also tribes were in a status of opening up and then closing down, you know, based on COVID numbers. Or there were some tribes I know in my home state of New Mexico that are still closed. Their tribal lands are still closed. Only essential workers, you know, probably tribal members are allowed on tribal lands. Non-tribal members or non-natives are not allowed to come into tribal lands. because their population is so small that any kind of infection outbreak would just be detrimental. So we had tribes that were like that, that, you know, would open and close, and so everything was virtual. So that is one of the things that really affected tribes. Also the opportunity to do those adjunct services, those self-help groups, some participation in cultural activities, because those were also shut down too. So those were just kind of some COVID issues that happened. But I also kind of want to highlight that there is a tribe here in New Mexico that the coordinator, she was on top of everything. During that time when the initial COVID kind of closures happened, she had a population of older Healing to Wellness Court participants who were not tech savvy. You know, they had phones, but they were able to play games every once in a while, you know, receive text messages, and they knew how to get on the web and things like that. And then there were some individuals who still had the flip phones. I didn't even know that those were still around, but they had those. So she kind of did a survey of her participants to find out, one, who needed a phone, a smartphone, and then two, who needed an email so she could communicate with them. And some of these individuals, I mean, like I have like 3 or 4 emails for different purposes. She got out there, she did that. She made sure everybody was connected. She also did Zoom tutorials. So because they went virtual with their Healing to Wellness Court, you know, she developed an SOP for all of her Healing to Wellness Court team and their team members, you know, and she updated it along the way as, you know, the trend started happening here in the state. So we saw things like that, you know, and that was great, you know, just that immediate response that, you know, and it's usually coordinators. Judge mentioned his staff and gave accolades to his coordinators. They're the backbones. They know everything. So she was able to do this and carry on a lot of those things. So that's kind of what we're also seeing on the national level, is that courts that have implemented a virtual kind of check-in, they're still maintaining, as the courts are able to meet or resume in person. But they're using that as an incentive, saying, okay, you're compliant with all of your stuff. You know, you can just check in by Zoom. Right. You know, we know you're working. We want you to keep working. So just check in with us by Zoom, you know, so that's your incentive, or that's your phase. That's, you know, your phase advancement. So they're continuing those kind of practices. I've also heard of talking circles, virtual talking circles that have occurred, you know, among Healing to Wellness Court participants. So they've really embraced those themes and found ways to sustain them and continue them because they see a value in them. So they've made these things work out of an awful situation. So yeah, I'm really proud, and I'm really glad that a lot of our Healing to Wellness Courts you know, found ways to adjust.
Mm-hmm. Creativity.
So the COVID, yeah, we've been in COVID for what, over almost 2 years now, I guess. I'm losing track. But we have a Head Start program up here. We have, you know, school on a reservation, you know, kindergarten through 12th grade, and very small school. I think our senior class last year was one of the bigger ones we ever had, which was close to 30 graduates we had here or whatever. But just kind of give you an idea of the size of our reservation. Well, if you ever looked on a map or ever been to Nia Bay, we're at the end of a road where a lot of people say it's the beginning, but it's basically a dead end. So when you drive, you really got to go out of your way to come here. You got to come here for a purpose. It's not like you're driving through and stop and keep going. So what we did, what the tribe did at the very beginning, and it's still here today, is we shut the reservation down. And we have a shack, a guard shack. Some people kind of jokingly call it Checkpoint Charlie, but we have a, it's manned 24/7. There's a police officer up there. And if you're not from here, you're not a tribal member, you get turned around and told to leave and are subject to getting a citation. A lot of people didn't understand that. Oh, this is America. I can go where we want. You know, we run into all of this, but how that has impacted our situation out here with Healing Court is a lot of people wanted to use that guard shack and that police presence and the stop to search vehicles and search people that may have drugs. And I had a lot of issues with that because of the, you know, the legal requirements to do something like that. Mm-hmm. And so that was a battle. And then and we all know, I mean, call it what it is, police are going to pick and choose who they're going to search and arrest and have their canine dog up there or whatever, you know, and it just wouldn't be across the board. So I had that challenge. People were, you know, getting up at meetings and on, you know, because the council has pretty much gone to Zoom meetings, but they would be like, we need to keep, you know, there are some people I want to keep that place there forever, thinking that's what's going to solve the problem. But sadly, I think the drug problem got worse during COVID. Mm-hmm. A lot of services got shut down. Our criminal DACA has been cut in about a third because we've lost police officers. Some of the police officers we do have just, you know, there's really not an incentive to be out patrolling the streets because a lot of people aren't out and about. We basically shut down out here. The one thing we did do with Healing Court though is we kept it going. We had Healing Court staffings every Wednesday. In fact, we ramped it up. We, even people that were above phase one and were biweekly participants were now on a weekly schedule with us because we wanted to keep track of them, and nobody balked at it. Nobody complained. And, you know, I'm phase two and I shouldn't have to be here. So I was very fortunate during that period. We're back to having in-person court right now. But yeah, COVID put a big, you know, everything, you know, you couldn't, it made it all hard. If you're a tribal employee, or can you imagine the government, you pick up the phone and call somebody you want to, and nobody answers the phone. Okay. They're non-essential and they're not here today or whatever, you know. Or I hate Zoom meetings locally here, you know, not so much something like this, you know, it's very practical and it's a good thing like this, but it's frustrating out here when you can't sit down face to face. I'm an interactive type person. If I'm meeting with the council or with the prosecutors or the police, I want to sit down at a table and look them straight in the eye and have that debate with them. And I think a lot of people took advantage of COVID, whether it was out of not wanting to do their job or avoid headaches or whatever the situation is. So COVID had I have to say had a bigger negative impact. You know, the school shut down, kids weren't allowed to play sports, you know, moms couldn't have childcare and weren't coming to work, and nobody was checking up on people. We UA our clients all the time. There was a, you know, they opened up a window of nobody really overseeing UAs and that type of thing. People were given the benefit of the doubt. Well, I went to a meeting, but nobody was there, you know, and it just was compounded everything, but we got through it, you know, To be very honest, you know, it's not, again, like I said earlier, it's not a perfect program. We have a lot of issues right now. We're kind of in a downtrend. We have more people out of compliance than in compliance. I think I have three or four right now that are on warrant status that we have not seen for a couple of months. Mm-hmm. And that's one unique thing about us out here. And I know a lot of other reservations probably have it too, but we get a lot of people that just up and leave. And, you know, they have court, whether it's criminal court or healing court, and they're like, screw this, I'm out of here. And so and where do they go? They go to other Indian reservations. Either they have relatives there or girlfriend, or they feel more comfortable. So we have a lot of couch surfers, we call them, that they leave and they end up somewhere. And I always emphasize to family, to other participants, tell them to come home. Nobody wants to live on the run. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you may have to come home and spend a few nights in jail, but you know, we want you to come back home. We want to be able to provide the services that, that you need. And, you know, we're not giving up on you. Right. We're going to do what we can. But COVID has really put, it didn't help. I'll just say it that way. You know, it hasn't helped in any way with anything. And, you know, the tribe took a hard stance on it. We lost a lot of tribal employees that refused to get vaccinated. And they said, hey, by this day, if you're not vaccinated, you're done. Mm. And, you know, and I was kind of there as a judge. You know, I was like, I don't want to say I was an anti-vaxxer, but I was just like, man, I don't know. But then I thought, well, you know, I'm older. What's the worst outcome going to happen to me? You know, so I'd be a lot more concerned if I was young and wanted to have families and kids and things like that. But in my predicament, I figured the benefit of being vaccinated outweighed the you know, any possible side effects or whatever. And I wanted to be able to address things in court and help the people and keep moving and not be selfish about it. And kind of looked at it as I took one for the team. I like to think that way. But yeah, we're still, you know, even with our criminal docket, we don't have in-person court hearings unless it's a trial. It's all via Zoom. Mm-hmm. And again, it doesn't have the same thing. But with our healing court, everything is in person. We can do the social distancing and we can do that. And hopefully the mask thing is done with. And it just gave a lot of people an opportunity, whether they were in the criminal courts or, you know, in some kind of legal jam, or whether they were just a tribal employee who didn't want to work. You know, a lot of people use COVID as an excuse to get out of what, you know, they were required to do on every level. And so COVID didn't help. So that was one of the challenges. And it kind of, I feel it in the last 6 months, it kind of put us to where our shortcomings are now greater than our positive results that we have. But that's expected. Mm-hmm. Right. Nobody's ready to give up, and it's still here because there may be that person tomorrow that can benefit from the program. Absolutely. So we try to remain positive because that's what you got to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Programs ebbing and flowing over time.
Right.
Kind of, you know, figuring out what works at the moment, given those external challenges that we have no control.
You know, and a lot of our sanctions were like Chris said earlier, everything got shut down. We went almost, I don't know, 2 years without even having a funeral here, you know, and funerals are a big thing for Native people, for us anyway out here. You know, it's a time of people coming home. You have a community dinner, you have a service, then you have another dinner, then you have a giveaway at some point. And it's a big cultural event, and we were unable to have that. We were unable to have a lot of things. Local basketball is the big thing in town, and you couldn't go to a basketball game. It was every basketball tournaments and things like that. Tourists coming out here. We're a tourist village because we're a fishing village. And it just completely changed everything. And you know, the tribe got a lot of money from the federal government. I'm not going to say whether that was a good thing or a bad thing. You know, throughout the country and Indian country, you know, that the local health officials now became the person making the rules and the laws. And we were all subject to that. And some of it I agreed with, some of it I didn't. But it was what it was. Mm-hmm. So I had to work through that. And we're not, you know, Washington State, our governor out here is very, you know, wear a mask, wear two masks, shut everything down type of individual. And people are just starting to get tired of it, including, you know, and we kind of follow the state through some of its health orders. And you have people on both sides. I'm not here to debate that, but all I'm saying is that the COVID situation did not help healing court, but it made us stronger. I'm going to put it that way. Just mm-hmm. You know.
So an additional challenge that we should discuss, or that we need to discuss, is the legalization of marijuana. Mm-hmm. Now, Judge Hoopt and I have told you a lot about tribes or sovereign nations. We have our own law and order codes. However, sometimes there are times that we follow the lead of whatever's going on in our states. And unfortunately, right now, there are some states that have legalized marijuana, and tribal communities are deciding whether or not to legalize it on their tribal lands. And there are some tribal communities that have already gone ahead and done so, mm-hmm. Not only just for the medical marijuana, but now they're considering recreational marijuana use. And there are some tribes who have made marijuana or cannabis production a business, and this is one of their business entities. So this is a whole nother kind of theme that is a challenge, not only just to tribes in general, but to tribal healing to wellness court programs. I've worked with tribes where they have had legalization of marijuana happen on their tribal lands, and seeing the number of their Healing to Wellness Court participants or the number of individuals coming into their program suffer. Kind of the thought is, you can't get me for it. It's legal. Why would I want to go through this program if marijuana is legal? If one of the substances that I'm using is legal, I only got in trouble for this, not for marijuana, so I don't want to be part of this program. So they have seen numbers dwindle, or referrals, or actual participants wanting to come in and participate in a Healing to Wellness Court. Those numbers have dropped. Also, there is an issue with drug testing. Drug courts and Healing to Wellness Courts are abstinence-based programs. We kind of expect you to be towards the latter parts of the programming, towards as you're getting ready to graduate. We kind of expect you to be free of any illicit or illegal or non-prescription drugs. And with this, I have also seen some tribal healing to wellness courts where, you have an individual come in and say, well, I have a card, I have a medical marijuana card, and this is a prescription. And this is, mm-hmm. You told me that if it was prescribed, for like medically assisted treatment, we have that
right.
Clause in some of our healing to wellness court and some of our drug court policies and procedures. And we oftentimes encourage it, judge is very fortunate in his community that it's accepted in the jail system. Mm-hmm. So, we have these individuals, we have this dilemma of, these individuals coming in with this medical marijuana card and saying, I have a prescription, I can use this. But also, with the research and the understanding that we have about drug use and, addiction and the drugs of use, and, all of our healing to wellness court and our drug court standards, that has been a difficult, how do you navigate around that? How do you have that conversation? How do you, so that has been a big challenge, to healing to wellness courts. And, I know that there are some tribes that, as Judge mentioned earlier, they are still dry communities, which they do not allow any alcohol on their tribal lands. It's, it's not sold. If you are caught with anything, really, it's either confiscated, you've given a citation or taken to jail, or, it's just not allowed. But, with the legalization of marijuana in neighboring non-tribal communities, we're having, to take a look at, is this something that we want or we should allow in our communities? And all of those things. And I know that states like Colorado and Oregon have had legalization for a very long time. So I know that some of the drug courts, the larger drug courts, are kind of looking to those states to to see what, you know, this many years in, what has been the process? What have there been pros and cons? Mm-hmm. So I think tribes are also going to be looking at that same information. You know, for example, tribes in Oregon, you know, what has their experience been? You know, what has their experience been with allowing someone, if they've allowed someone to come into a healing to wellness court with a medical marijuana card? You know, so it's a topic of discussion, and sometimes it can be a heated topic of discussion with tribal individuals, tribal treatment providers, tribal court staff, tribal law enforcement, because they're the first line of defense, you know, for us is whatever they see. And yeah, so it's been a challenge, and it's one of those things that I don't know if there's an answer that, or a situation that makes everybody happy, mm-hmm. or that is, you know, it still is a challenge.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and touch a little bit on that. You know, it's very ironic that, you know, somebody like I'm a little from the little bit older generation where, you know, I was raised that marijuana was a platform drug, and you know it wasn't good. I think the science has changed on that. Marijuana is illegal here. We're probably one of the very few tribes in a state that has legalized it. So I was saying, ironically, earlier is what I've seen other tribes, and more power to them. But we have a couple of other tribes that are fairly close by, and they sell marijuana, they have a casino, and they have mini marts with beer caves all within, right in the same area. And I was raised that, you know, those were some of the sins of natives, was gambling, drugs, and alcohol. And they're profiting off of it. But I don't want to go down that discussion. All I want to do is talk about how that has impacted us here on my reservation is... marijuana is illegal. I have my own views on that. I would rather see somebody, you know, indulging in perhaps marijuana rather than heroin or meth, obviously. But what is sad in the state of Washington, for the listeners that are not from or have no idea, and some of them that may do, you know, I was born in Seattle, and I love Seattle. I love the Seahawks, the Mariners, everything Seattle has to offer. Seattle is I love it. I go there. I got to go get my Seattle fix probably, you know, once a month. Go there and just walk around downtown and see the atmosphere. A lot of natives there, you know, a lot of culture and different things. But in the last 2 years, and it's not just COVID, Seattle has disintegrated. It is sad to go down there. You see people shooting heroin up and the cops just walking by. You see needles all over the place. In Seattle and probably a lot of places in Washington, heroin has just become, I don't want to say accepted, but it's just something that, you know, the police, I think, are frustrated. You know, the big defund the policemen, you know, or the mayor we had in Seattle, the politics that we've had. You know, it basically just condoned it. You can't even get arrested in Seattle for shoplifting if you can tie it into feeding your drug habit. So, and it kind of has that reverse effect. You know, in my day, it was, man, if you stay on the reservation, you won't get in big trouble. You know, don't go to the city, don't go in there, because you'll go to a real jail and you'll get in real trouble. It'll be on your record. You'll get a felony. Stay home and be crazy on the res, and nobody else will ever know about it. We've almost come 180 from that philosophy. You want to go smoke marijuana legally and not worry about it, you know, today. If you want to walk around with needles and paraphernalia in your pocket and shoot up heroin, go downtown Seattle and hang out with those folks down there, and you don't have to worry about it. You do that up here, you're going to jail. And, but as far as like marijuana, you know, we have a bigger issue up here with employees, people that, hey, you know, I can't get a job because I'll test positive for THC. And right now in our healing court, if they test positive for THC, it's on the books. You can't do it. You're violating your contract with healing court. You know, it'd be addressed accordingly. But you know, I've had clients in here saying, man, if I'm smoking weed, I feel better and I'm not going to do the other kind of stuff. I mean, they come right out and they'll tell you. Mm-hmm. And why can't I do it here? I can go into Port Angeles and just buy it and be okay with it. And, you know, I don't know. You know, I came from that reefer madness generation, I guess, where we were all told it was the worst possible thing you can do. And I know that's, you know, I'm not making light of it, but that's, you know, we got bigger things to be concerned about. I don't get all excited if somebody has a positive for THC. You know, I'm not going to condone it, but I'm not going to, you know, address it like I would if it was you know, heroin or meth or something like that. But yeah, I don't know what the answer is. We are still so ingrained out here in the old ways of looking at alcohol and drugs. It's black and white to the older people. I mean, if you were to talk to my mom, who's 87 years old, you know, it's taboo. You just do not go there. And she grew up in a generation of a lot of alcoholism. You know, a lot of people dying young. I think sadly, alcohol's the forgotten drug or vice that people have. I think alcohol probably kills and does more damage than all the other drugs put together. But it's accepted. In the outside world, it's not here because we're on a dry reservation. But you know, I always joke we're a dry reservation. We have the alcoholics to prove it. Meaning, we have people out here. You know, you can go almost in any house, and alcohol here, it's just kind of like, well, as long as you're at home and you're not, you know, you're not at the ballpark or out on the beach, at a party, you're okay. So it's like, don't ask, don't tell, and. That's how that's addressed. But to make it legal, it's not going to happen in my generation, either alcohol or marijuana. So we have to address those. But my big battle out here right now, my focus is heroin. And with heroin, you know, you can go out and with alcohol and I, you know, depending on what level you're at, you know, it can be pretty hard. It can be deadly. But what I see with my heroin addicts that come through the criminal system or have relapsed through healing court is, and I got to follow the code, but I pretty much got the prosecutors on board, and I've talked to enough addicts that if they've relapsed or somebody is actively using, is that they're very fearful of detoxing and going through withdrawals. Right. And if I get somebody that has got arrested, I'm going to try to keep them in jail to detox them. And we have the medical personnel, and we have the ability to watch for them and take care of them. But I see a difference between night and day when somebody comes in here, say for a criminal arraignment, which I have to have within 48 hours, if they're using, I can just tell by looking at them, you know, and if it's not part of their charge, I ask them, are you using? If I were UAU right now, would it be positive? And most of them are honest. They're angry or they're sick or they're tired. They look like, you know, hell, excuse the language, but they look bad. If I can keep them in jail 5 to 7 days and detox them and they come back for another hearing, they look totally different. They're ready. I'm not going to offer somebody that's in that previous situation a plea deal or the thought of getting into healing court. At that point, they're going to say whatever it takes to get them out of jail and get their next fix. You know, I've seen that hundreds of times. So I'm going to use every avenue I know to detox that person in our local facility and get them at least clear-headed to where they can start thinking about treatment or whatever. And it doesn't work for everybody, but it gives us that advantage. It gives them that advantage and they're done. And it, I think it's proven that people detox in a correctional facility a lot better than they do either at a treatment facility or at home. I have a lot of people say, well, let me detox at home. And they have it in the back of their mind that, hey, I can walk out this door any minute and get a fix. So detoxing at home is a lot harder. If you're in jail and you don't have any other choice, you tough through it and you get through it faster. I think that's been clinically proven that it worked that way. You got to be careful. You know, you got to have the tools. You got to have the personnel at the jail, you know, to keep an eye on them and have the clinic on board to give them, you know, any type of medication they may need. But when I legally can, you know, because I'm bound by the law and order code on certain timeline requirements to keep them in jail and detox them and then start negotiating some type of settlement or conclusion to their situation.
Yeah. And I think that's great, Judge, that you have that medical, the medical and the treatment folks there that can actually oversee that process. Because I know that's something that, you know, programs across the country really struggle with. You know, how do we respond to that? So the fact that you all have the resources there available in the jail is great.
And that goes back to the advantage of having our own jail. Mm-hmm. You know, you get flushed into if you were in King County Jail or God forbid Pierce County, which is Tacoma, your family would never know if you're even alive, you know, and what's going on and how you're going to be, or if you're just going to be forgotten and you know, yeah. So that part of having our own jail facility is great.
Yeah.
So with all of our Justice to Healing podcasts, we like to talk a little bit about bridging that practitioner and researcher divide by talking about the research related to the specific court. So talking about tribal healing to wellness courts, we know that there's probably, we would say, a dearth of research on tribal healing to wellness courts, but there have been some studies that have been done. Chris, can you talk a little bit about the research that has been done in the past and then maybe lead us into a discussion around the lessons learned from the research that has been done and then maybe a little bit around what are the outcomes that we would like to look at if we, you know, could design the perfect study of tribal healing to wellness courts?
Of course. So you are right. Tribal healing to wellness courts are very, there's very little research about them, you know, and probably research that you all would conduct, you know, this, you know, surveys and, you know, talking with individuals there's very little. And partly because, unfortunately, the sustainability factor of healing to wellness courts, sometimes healing to wellness courts or tribal communities will get a federal grant, a BJA grant, which, you know, they're totally eligible for, or a CTAS grant. And, you know, unfortunately, that healing to wellness court lasts the duration of the grant period time, 3, 4, 5 years sometimes. And so they don't stay in business long enough for us to kind of take a look at what's going on. So it's really important. Sustainability is one of those important kind of factors. But there was a study conducted 2004, 2005. It actually was published and came out in December of 2005 by Karen Gottlieb, PhD, JD. And so she did the official title is called Lessons Learned in Implementing the first four tribal wellness courts. And what she did was those first wellness courts that received BJA funding and some initial training and technical assistance, those tribes were the Hualapai community in Arizona, the Blackfeet in Montana, Fort Peck Reservation also in Montana, and Porch Creek in Alabama. So those were the first four healing to wellness courts. So she got a chance to take a look at them, you know, where not only the national standards were applied, but the 10 key components, which is what we at TLPI work with and work with our healing to wellness courts, utilizing that. And so she came up with a list of lessons learned And I, what's really nice is as we've had this conversation, some of those themes have been brought out. You know, Judge earlier mentioned having that backing of the community, that in his community, he has that backing from his tribal council, from the community in general, and that the alumni sometimes are the best advocates right. for the program. So there's great community buy-in. There is great, you know, this, everybody knows about it. They know what Healing to Wellness Court does. So that was actually one of the lessons learned. And one of the recommendations was that get in that community buy-in, get in that community input from day one, you know, and this is done through an advisory group, a steering group, you know, although I know Judge probably doesn't like to do this very often, but going to tribal council, you know, keeping tribal council in the loop of all of this information. This is what we want to do. This, we have a policies and procedure manual. We have a handbook. This is, these are our phase structure, letting them know. And then taking that to the community, because I'm sure there are probably individuals in the community who said, oh, you know, I have a son who should be in that program, or, you know, my grandson or my granddaughter. So that public knowledge, so building that community input and that community support is one of those important themes. And another theme that we've talked about and Judge also mentioned is the staff, the team. There's a great importance on the team, the development of the team, who you have on the team, and how they're brought into the team is also really important. You know, as I've worked across with other tribal communities, we have seen, you know, teams as large as 10, 12, 13 people, you know, they come into either a staffing or an advisory meeting, and, you know, they each tell us our role, or each tell us, you know, what their role is on the team. And then we get down to the staffing team, and, you know, there's maybe about six or seven, you know, those core people who are actually doing the work. Mm-hmm. It's a very team, and, you know, that team helps lead us to that nation building. You know, Judge all is one of those definitely important kind of people. They're the leaders. They, you know, they set the precedence for court, you know, and Judge talked about it earlier when he was talking about how, you know, in court, they can't call him John, you know, they call him Judge, and, you know, that he makes sure they remember to take their hat off, and, you know, but he's there to listen to them. It's very different from his experience in criminal court versus Healing to Wellness Court. You know, coordinators. We have talked a lot about coordinators and their important role because they're the quarterbacks of our team. You know, the judge is the coach, but the coordinators are the quarterbacks. They're the ones who gather all the people together. They gather all the other resources. They make sure that those individual program people know what is going on, gathering information from those individuals. And this is also very unique to Healing to Wellness Courts, a cultural liaison or an elder. There was some, you know, special consideration paid to having those individuals, not only just on an advisory team, but maybe on the staffing team. Mm-hmm. And from my experience as a Healing to Wellness Court practitioner, I will tell you that having a tribal elder on your team is so very valuable. When I was a probation officer, we were very fortunate to have the tribal secretary on our Healing to Wellness Court team. And so she not only was our liaison to our tribal council, but she sat in on staffing and Healing to Wellness Court status hearings. And I remember one incident where this individual was getting a sanction. He had absconded for a few days, missed a drug test, missed several Healing to Wellness Court requirements, and was also looking at some jail time. And so we all got an opportunity to let him know that, you know, we're still here for him. But she was an older woman. She went directly to him. She spoke to him in our language, in our Laguna language. And she told him, you know, we still love you. You're still my grandson. I still love you. And I want you to do good. So go do what you need to do. Go do your time and come back and we'll be here. Before, as the Healing to Wellness Court team were talking to him, very stoic, she got up, spoke up. He was crying. It really impacted him. Mm-hmm. And I still have that picture in my mind today. Whenever I, you know, tell it, so I can still see her and I can still hear her words. So that, again, like I said, is one of those unique things with Healing to Wellness Court, is having an elder, having a cultural liaison, because what that also does is it tells the team and it lets the team know, you know, that these are things that are culturally relevant that, you know, maybe you can apply in a case plan, or maybe you can have the participant work on, or they also are able to provide some cultural knowledge. One of the courts that I was very fortunate to visit before COVID happened, they also had a tribal councilman sit on their team, and he was fluent in their language. And so this particular Healing to Wellness Court team would give the participants a phrase to learn in their language. And they would have the cultural liaison practice with them and, you know, go back and forth. And so at the status hearing, they would also, they would repeat that phrase in their native language. And so it served two purposes. It was great because they were learning the language, but they were learning to put together a conversation. So, and that's really important for us, is It's important for myself, not only as a Native person, but it's important for my parents to know that I can introduce myself in my traditional language, that I can tell others what my clans are, to see if there's any relation between us, and that I can tell them my parents are such and such. We might have a blood relation. So putting those themes together and being able to say that and build their language base and have the opportunity to practice, and then also have the opportunity to have a pat on the back or say, you know, that's great. Just, you know, is one of those things. So it's another one of those unique themes of Healing to Wellness Courts. It's one of the themes that was found in the study. It's one of those themes that we emphasize when we work, when we do training and technical assistance, is the cultural. And it's also one of those questions that Healing to Wellness Courts always bring to us, is how to incorporate the culture. So we have, you know, and like I said before, there are 570 plus tribes, federally recognized tribes of us, and we're all different. So this is that point where we tell, do you have a cultural liaison? Do you have an elder in your community that maybe can help better guide you with this? So those are just a couple of the themes, you know, that really spoke out, you know, that really spoke out to me of, you know, some of those lessons learned were staff, structure, and the use of culture.
That was great. So I'm not sure where to go from there.
I was gonna say there's a few more. There's things like staff training and, you know, developing a curriculum and, mm-hmm. you know, but those things are very similar to drug courts, right? Mm-hmm. You know, regular drug courts, you know, those are things that, you know, we would tell other drug courts, but those were just kind of the big things that I found in this study.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like just to add to that is one thing that, you know, we got a lot of help and a lot of, you know, reviews. Chris and them have been up here, and we can always pick up the phone and call and talk, or we have a mentor tribe that we can go to if we have, you know, questions, or how do we do this? One of the questions we had is if somebody's been through the program and has graduated and they had their big fanfare and they got their blanket and they got their speeches, say they relapse 2 years later and they get back in trouble, are we going to take them back into healing court? Are they going to be able basically to come through the program a second time? And we have a couple of those individuals right now. We allowed one in. It's kind of a case by case basis. We don't know how that's going to work out. But as far as like research and being able to Google something, you know, outside of our native programs we have and what Chris and them are able to offer us, I think the biggest help for us outside of trying to polish our own program is we have an annual conference that we go to where we can sit around and out of a lot of the conferences I go to every year, Healing Court is definitely the most fulfilling and the most we learn because it's still an evolving thing. It's still something that, you know, it's not one of these conferences where everybody's out in the lobby and visiting and drinking coffee and going to the casinos or whatever. The Healing Court Conference is actually one where you walk away with new ideas, good information, good contacts, good networking. And one thing that I like to take a little bit of credit for is I was able to get the council to pass a new resolution allowing people to become Healing Court participants that were not in the criminal system. We did not want to send a message to people, you got to get in trouble first before you can access help. So we've had a few come into the program on a voluntary basis. They follow the same rules. It's very explained to them what the only trick is, that as a sanction, I can't put them in jail because they don't have any jail time hanging over their head, but they're going to pick up trash. They're going to be called out. They're going to be subject to UAs. And it's been positive. And I brought that up at national conferences and they're like, hey, we never thought of that. Mm-hmm. And I like to think, you know, that I had a major role in it because I saw, you know, I heard people saying, well, God, I'd like to do that, but what do I got to do to get in? And right. At that time, it's like, well, you got to break the law to get in. Uh-huh. Yeah. So, you know, you want to view it as, you know, I don't want to compare it with church, but, you know, the doors are open. You know, if you need help, there'll be somebody there to help you. Kind of on a lighter note, Chris was talking, you know, about elders in the program and you know, utilizing elders. You know, we had a staffing one time and we were thinking about a different sanction for an individual. And I really got blasted and maybe rightfully so. I said, well, maybe one of the sanctions is this young gal should spend maybe 5 hours with an elder. And the jaws dropped and one lady was really offended saying, that's not a sanction, that's an incentive. You know, it's a good thing that you know, to spend time with an elder. It's not punishment. Mm. And I'm thinking in my mind, God, you know, it all depends. We all have those people we think it would be punishment. But so I got to be real careful on how I view that. You know, I wasn't really raised all that cultural, you know, but we do have a language program. We do a lot of, you know, our festivities and our dancing and our culture. And I was one of these guys growing up, I'd rather be playing basketball than Indian dancing and doing that kind of thing. But we're very in tune. We were going to talk about getting an elders panel, but that has been put on the side. We didn't know if that was in our community knowing, you know, are we going to be going backwards instead of forward with that idea? Is it really the right time and place? We do have one community rep on our healing team who has been down that road, but he's been clean and sober, I think, for 13 years. And he has a lot to bring to the table. He's the kind of guy that wants to take people hiking and camping and things like that. But as far as getting research and finding out information, how to better run your program, a lot of it is just by trial and error. Mm-hmm. The reaching out to other tribal communities and going to these national conferences with other Native American tribes is the best. Real quickly, I went to one when I first started. I went to the county drug court for a graduation. We had a tribal member that wasn't living on the reservation, but was in their drug court program. And I just didn't like the way it was ran. You know, when the guy graduated, the judge pulled out a picture of his booking rap sheet and he looked terrible and everybody's laughing and things like that. I just didn't think that was appropriate. So people, are you going to do that in your court? And no, I won't. We need to look forward, not back, is my philosophy. And but again, the county, you can't compare them. It's not really fair because those people in that system are in there for felony crimes. And they're looking at, if they don't get through the program, you know, 3-5 years in prison, where tribal courts are a court of misdemeanor jurisdiction. And we're well aware of that. Sometimes that works against us, because I've had people say, I'm not going to go I'll take my chances in criminal court. What's the worst that's going to happen? 30 days in jail versus 12 months of jumping through hoops and doing something I really don't want to do. And as far as research and things going on, the best reference manuals is what we do here, what works and doesn't work. And second is utilizing programs like Chris is involved in our national conferences. Sadly, COVID has put us on a Zoom thing here for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. So hopefully, Chris, I don't know if she's there, but can advocate that we go back to in-person conferences.
Yeah.
So we're at the point of kind of wrapping up and doing the call to action, but we always ask our guests before we do that, is there anything that we missed or anything else that you wanted to talk about that we may not have asked you about?
You know, when drugs was so bad when I got here, and it's still bad, but when I got here as a judge, I think I was here for maybe a year or whatever, the general manager and different people were, you know, kind of brainstorming, sitting around round tabling. And I got called into it to a meeting with the council wasn't there, but the individual brought up and said, the council wants it. And then they're looking at me saying, you know, the council wants to know from you, how are you going to fix our drug problem? And I said, God, if I had the answer to that, I probably wouldn't be working for the tribe. I said, I don't think nobody knows what the answer is, but I know what you know, doesn't work. And what doesn't work is continually throwing people into jail. You know, you got to have a treatment end of it. You got to have some type of, you know, you may resolve the problem for 30 days, 90 days or whatever the situation is, but you're not going to fix it. You got to give the people an opportunity and the tools to fix themselves. And, you know, the best we can do is give them that ability. And a lot of it's on them. You know, I hear a lot of criticism from people saying, well, you know, addicts just need to say no and they just need to quit doing it. Well, people don't understand it's a disease.
Right.
It's a sickness. And you just can't take a pill and get over it. It's a lifetime commitment of sobriety and change and fighting that battle. And I'll tell you what, I've told these guys here in my court, and I'm proud of you. You guys that have living this life, you know, you're warriors, and I'm proud of you. And you're fighting a battle. A lot of us don't know. Mm-hmm. And you know, nobody wants to be an addict, you know, and regardless of what they say, they want to be, you know, good people, and we need to give them that opportunity to be able to reach that. Mm-hmm.
Well, that is a great call to action.
You know, I always want to end. I always tell everybody, you know, I've been a judge for 9 years. I was law enforcement for 21. And I saw a lot of bad things. I you know, a lot of things that weren't, you know, it's not like a guy building a house at the end of the day can say, hey, see what I accomplished. A lot of it was negativity type stuff. A lot of stuff that just you can't erase. And so when I became a judge, you know, it's hard. Being a judge is a very lonely life. You know, you're not, I don't even get on Facebook. You know, I go to work and I go home, and I don't go to tribal council meetings and stand up and be able to air my concerns. I got to remain professional and ethical. And being a judge, you know, I do all the dockets, criminal docket, probation docket, civil dockets. And there's either a loser or a winner in those. And a lot of times the losers are going to jail, they're losing their kids, they're getting evicted from their house, or getting terminated from their jobs, or getting excluded from the reservation. The negativity just never ends. But with Healing Court, there's success. And I tell these clients of mine, if it wasn't for this Healing Court docket on my in my courtroom, I don't think I could do this job. This is the thing that re-energizes me. It gives me a reason to think that I'm actually accomplishing something. And so the Healing Court, I tell them, it's not just helping you, it's helping me.
Right.
And I have it right in the middle of the week. So
right.
gets you through hump day.
It's not all peaches and cream sometimes, but it mm-hmm. does give you a sense that you are able to help somebody. In fact, I was at a Costco here maybe 6 months ago, and I saw a client in there with his girlfriend and their little girl. And they were like, "Hey, who is that?" And that little girl said, "That's Judge Hopp." And came over and gave me a hug, you know. So that kind of stuff, you know, brings tears to your eyes, and but it makes it worth it.
Sure.
So you're just, like I said from the beginning, when you're helping somebody, you're not just helping them, you're helping their families and the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So in that same vein, you know, just something to take away is that problem solving courts, healing to wellness courts, they work. They are a lot of work of putting together time, and you know, there's some setbacks, and you know, for those courts maybe that are no longer with us, they have still made an impact in that community. And people still remember, "Oh, I remember when Healing to Wellness Court was here." We need to bring that back. You know, but they do work. And you know, in the same vein of Judge telling you about the family he saw, you know, I let you know earlier that I was a Healing to Wellness Court practitioner as a coordinator, probation officer, and a treatment provider. And so my last role was as a treatment provider. And so as I'm transitioned into an administrative position, I was told I couldn't carry caseload anymore. So this kind of also pulled me out of wellness court. And so the last client that I had in Healing to Wellness Court, I saw him recently in the community. And I don't, just kind of like Judge, I don't approach them. I wait to let them approach me, because someone may ask, "Well, how do you know her? You know, I know she was a probation officer. I know she used to work for behavioral health." So I just kind of wait for people to approach me. So he came up to me and let me know recently. He said, he said, "I have 7 years of sobriety."
Oh, wow.
"I'm still sober." He's working at one of our casinos. He looks good. And he said, "I just want to thank you, you know, for the work you did." And I'm like, "I didn't do any of that work. You did.
Yeah.
You did all of the work. I just cheered you on. And I just, you know, I was just there." But you don't get those very often, but when you do, like Judge said, they bring tears to your eyes, and you're just like, "This is, you know, okay, this is why I do this.
Right.
This is why I do this. This is why I did this in my home community, but why I do it on a national level, because I've been very fortunate to be given the opportunity to work with other tribes, is when someone else in my role as a coordinator, as a clinician, as a probation officer, get that person and they come back and they tell them, "Thank you."
Mm-hmm, right.
Or when the judge gets a thank you. And part of it is because we've been able to offer them a little bit of information, a little bit of training, opportunities to talk to other Healing to Wellness courts. A judge mentioned that they work with a mentor court sometimes. So that this is why I do it, because they work. Mm-hmm. They work.
I think you guys have given our listeners a lot to take away in terms of, you know, sort of applying this information to practice. So how can we translate that, which is really the spirit of the center? So we would like to thank you for joining us today, Chris and Judge Hopp. been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, thank you for being here. We hope that you learned something new during the episode. Join us next month for another episode of Justice to Healing, and always remember to do better.
To our listeners, we thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the show. Be sure to hit subscribe to stay updated on the podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn to stay engaged with us, and check out our website at ndcrc.org. Thanks again. Catch you next time on Justice to Healing. The Justice to Healing podcast is presented by the National Drug Court Resource Center and was supported by the grant number 2019-DC-BXK-002, awarded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance, which also includes the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the National Institute of Justice, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, the Office for Victims of Crime, and the Smart Office. Points of view or opinions in this podcast are those of the author and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the United States Department of Justice.